Welcome, everyone, to the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. This is your host for today, Christian Powell, a first-year master's student in the Medieval Studies program here at Fordham University. Joining me today is my friend and classmate, Thomas Warren, who is also a first-year master's student in the Medieval Studies program. We're coming to you today from the podcast studio of the Walsh Family Library at Fordham University on this chilly afternoon. Before we begin, I'd like to thank the Medieval Academy of America for giving me the opportunity to make an episode for the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast. And I would like to thank Fordham University for making available to all students this wonderful podcast studio. Now let's begin. First of all, Thomas, thank you for joining me today. How are you doing?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Very good. And for those who are listening who don't have the privilege to know you like I do, what are you studying here at Fordham?
So it's a little bit different than the topic that we're doing here today, but I'm mostly interested in the intellectual history of the 12th and 13th centuries, especially clerics who studied in Paris at Saint-Genève or Saint-Victor. Anything they wrote, all kinds of different texts, sermons, historiography, poetry, legal texts. And I'm also very interested about their experiences when they returned home.
That's really good to hear. And for the listeners and for you, even if it's not immediately relevant to your studies, you're all in for a real treat today because the story of Theodore of Tarsus is a story that every student of the Middle Ages, and for all of history for that matter, should know. Absolutely nobody in the early Middle Ages lived as multicultural of a life as Theodore of Tarsus. And I firmly believe that Theodore's story represents everything this podcast series stands for, namely that multiculturalism was more common during the Middle Ages than is often represented in the media, and thus in the popular imagination. Now, I'd like to begin in a kind of unconventional way by recounting a story not from history, but from the fictional world of J.R.R. Tolkien. In the third volume of his series, The Lord of the Rings, titled The Return of the King, Tolkien recounts a little story about two nations that are faced with a great evil, the Kingdom of Gondor and the Kingdom of Rohan. And the Kingdom of Gondor is in this really horrible war and needs to call for help. So they light a series of beacons to let their friends up in Rohan know that they need help. And although Tolkien was taking the story of the beacons from early medieval Byzantium, I think the imagery of the beacons also shows the light that existed in a lot of intellectual figures in the early medieval West. People like Isidore of Seville, Benedict of Nursia, and also, very truly, Theodore of Tarsus. He was really a beacon of light in the middle of England at a time when it was really struggling, and he established a lot of really great intellectual centers in this land.
I really like that metaphor of the beacons because for my own interests, the 12th century figures themselves, they always talked about how they stood on the shoulders of giants. All these people who had come before them allowed for the Renaissance of the 12th century and that flourishing of all kinds of different theological and intellectual and literary cultures. And so Theodore of Tarsus is perhaps an underestimated figure in terms of the contributions that he brought to the medieval West and the intellectual tradition.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting to think about Theodore because he travels from a land that is built by giants. After the Romans leave England, people say that they're living among the ruins of giants when they're observing the Roman ruins because they can't imagine a society that could build such monuments. Like people living in what is now England, living among the ruins in the 5th, 6th, 7th centuries. And so travelers who would come from England to the great cities like Rome and Constantinople and Jerusalem are going to feel a great sense of awe in these places that are inconceivably distant from their homes and also almost mythical in their minds. And Theodore of Tarsus was very much the same way because he's called Theodore of Tarsus, which is nowhere near England, and he ends up in Canterbury as the Archbishop, which is, you know, a very amazing story because after he goes from Tarsus through many of the great cities of the ancient world, Antioch, Constantinople, and Rome, he ends up in a place that is very nearly alien to him and inconceivably distant from his home. Before we talk about what Theodore ended up doing during his time as Archbishop of Canterbury in modern-day England, we have to talk about how he got there in the first place. Now, a quick disclaimer, a lot of what I'm about to tell you about the early life of Theodore is based on speculation by numerous different scholars, especially scholars like Michael Lepage. They are built upon a lot of different works that were produced by Theodore and his school at Canterbury, and we can take details from these works, and we'll get more into this later in the podcast, but we can take details from these different works and understand the different places that Theodore visited, the different places he was a student at before he ended up as Archbishop of Canterbury. Virtually all of what we know, primarily, all the primary sources we have for Theodore of Tarsus, they all disseminate from Bede the Venerable, his Ecclesiastical History of the English People, which is written about a generation, about like 30 or 40 years after Theodore's death. Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People. If you're not familiar, it's pretty much the main primary source we have for Christianity in the early Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. It's one of the best histories of the early Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. If Bede is to be believed, Theodore of Tarsus died on the 19th of September in the year 690. And if Bede is correct in his writings that Theodore died at the age of 88, that means he was born sometime in the year 602, during the final year of the Emperor Maurice and Theodosius. So Theodore was born in Tarsus, which is located in the modern-day nation of Turkey, in a region that was known to the Byzantines as Cilicia. Tarsus is the capital of Cilicia. It's like the state capital. It's like the Albany of Cilicia. It's important to note that Tarsus is also the city where the Apostle Paul comes from, Paul of Tarsus. So it was a very well-known city to a lot of people because they would have known that a man who wrote a big chunk of the New Testament came from this city in Cilicia, which is in like southeastern Turkey. This is where some problems about his early life arise for scholars, as aside from the detail that Theodore was born in 602 and that he hailed from Tarsus, Bede gives us virtually no other information about his early life. This isn't really Bede's fault. He almost certainly wouldn't have known any additional information about Theodore's early life. But for centuries, this made it so that Theodore's early life was mainly an afterthought for most historians. Thankfully, though, within the last few decades, this has changed. Historians like Michael Lepage and Bernard Bischoff and many others have used the surviving writers of Theodore and his students to paint an incredibly vibrant and detailed picture of Theodore's life. We're going to get into the exact process that they use as we go along. I'll tell you what the sources we have for different details are. Most of them are the biblical commentaries that come out of Theodore's school in Canterbury, which is not like your everyday biblical commentary. When Theodore was born, the Byzantine Empire, within whose borders he lived, was still the dominant force in the Mediterranean. They controlled land in Italy, southern Spain, the Balkans, Greece, virtually all of North Africa, Egypt, and the Levant, and had its heartland in Asia Minor, again, modern-day Turkey. Within months of Theodore being born, we don't know when exactly he was born, but by the end of the year that Theodore was born, the Emperor of Byzantium, Maurice, was overthrown and killed by a man named Phocas. Thomas, you know anything about Phocas?
I can't say that I've heard of him.
Well, he is far and away considered the absolute worst Byzantine emperor. Everybody that I've heard talk about him talks about him as a very horrible emperor, politically, economically, militarily. He just sounds like he wasn't really a great guy. And immediately following the ascension of Phocas to the Byzantine throne, the Persian Empire ended up invading the Byzantine Empire. They used the excuse that Maurice was overthrown unjustly and that Maurice was their ally, so they invaded the empire against Phocas, but really is because they wanted to take Byzantine territory. They started by invading Byzantine Mesopotamia and Armenia. And it's interesting to note that as Theodore got older, he almost certainly would have heard stories about this war. He would have known how ancient this rivalry was between the Romans, the Eastern Romans, and the Persians. He would have known that they had fought many wars with each other, and they had been doing so since before the time of Christ. And as he got older, those stories from farther off lands would have suddenly started to get a little closer and closer until in 613, the city of Antioch, located just 100 miles from Tarsus, was captured by the Persians, and Tarsus fell not long after. So now Theodore finds his hometown under the occupation of the Sassanid Persians, and soon after, most Syria, a little bit later Egypt, and Palestine were also under Persian control. So Theodore was about 12 when Tarsus is taken by the Persians, and their advance kind of stops there because of the Taurus Mountains. That's kind of a really big buffer for a lot of invading armies, is they end up not being able to pass the Taurus Mountains, so they halt their advance, at least for a while. And this is Theodore's first interaction with another culture. Now, it certainly will not be his only, as we're going to talk about soon. And it's not fully understood how Theodore interacted with the Persians who were occupying Antioch. Theodore was probably in Antioch doing schooling by the time the Persians invaded. At the age of 12, he would have already been doing schooling. And we know, just a quick aside, we know that Theodore was probably in Antioch based on some of the biblical commentaries. They have a specific kind of Antiochian exegetical style to them. Exegesis is a way of commentating or explaining passages in the Bible. It was very, very popular in the late antique and early medieval world. Still very common today. You'll see long notes underneath a lot of like study Bibles. And the Antiochian style specifically is focused not so much on theological details, but it's very focused on literal details. Now, I don't mean biblical literalism in the postmodern evangelical sense. That's a postmodern invention. What I mean by literal is they're focused on the plants. They care about the animals. They care about the towns. And they care about the cultural details. And we know that Theodore interacted with the Persians that were occupying Antioch and Tarsus because there are a lot of details pertaining to Persian culture in the Canterbury biblical commentaries, which nobody else at his school in Canterbury would have known because he was pretty much the only one at the school that had interacted with Persian culture.
Exegesis also is massively popular in the 12th century and the 13th century. So it's pretty fascinating to think about, you know, Theodore of Tarsus might have brought along that Antiochian kind of style of exegesis, which is very typified in works like Peter Chemester's Historia Scholastica, where it's just a very straightforward historical analysis of the Bible and, you know, sort of tapping into other sources like, you know, Josephus or other things to explain the surrounding events of what's happening in the Bible.
Absolutely. And I feel like even today when I watch videos explaining the Bible from different scholars like Bart Ehrman, they're very, very focused on the historical details. They're focused on like historians like Josephus or Pliny the Elder. They want to know what it actually looked like when it happened. They're in that search of, people always say, the historical Jesus. And that's kind of what the Antiochian school is all about, is again focusing on little cultural details. So when they are talking about Cyrus the Great, they're making an observation of Persian culture as they would have known it. Again, this period is quite shaky, but it's not just the Antiochian biblical exegetes that Theodore is quoting. He also quotes a lot of Syriac biblical exegetes, specifically Ephrem the Syrian. He is a Syriac writer. He lives about 300 years before Theodore. And so what this leads scholars to believe is that Theodore might have also spent time in the city of Edessa, which is about 150 miles from Antioch. Now, it's during either Theodore's time in Antioch or Edessa that the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius was able to lift the Persian occupation, and he pushed into Persian territory. By the time that this last Great War of Antiquity, as it's often called, ended, Theodore was about 25 or 26 years old. And for the first time in his life, there was no war. Again, he's born in 602. The Byzantine-Sasanian War starts in 602. And the war ends when he's 25 or 26. So the first almost 30 years of his life are spent in war, which is kind of remarkable. And as we're going to see, he ends up having to become a refugee. There's speculation about whether he became a refugee during the Persian occupation, but it seems the scholarly consensus leans more towards that he was a refugee of the Arab invasions, which happened just a decade or so after Heraclius defeats the Persians. The Arabs, newly converted to Islam, start to invade the Byzantine Empire. So although he tolerated the Persian occupation and the Byzantine-Sasanian War, the Arab invasion saw Theodore flee, along with many other refugees, to Constantinople. They took Antioch, they took Edessa, they took Jerusalem, and not long after they would have taken Alexandria and parts of northern Africa. So it's unknown exactly when Theodore leaves Antioch or Edessa and goes to Constantinople, but Michael LePage believes it's no later than 637. So he's in his early to mid-30s by the time he leaves for Constantinople. And there in Constantinople, his presence and activities are a lot better documented. Once again, the biblical commentaries really help us out. They explicitly mention that Theodore goes to Constantinople and that he sees some relics. The biblical commentaries actually say that he saw the relics of the 12 baskets that hold the fish and the bread that Jesus feeds the 5,000 with in the Gospels. They say he was able to see these relics in Constantinople. But the timeline gets kind of iffy between there. We don't know exactly what else he was doing in Constantinople. But again, along with the biblical commentaries, we see he has a great familiarity with Byzantine law. His Eudicia, which is one of the writings that is directly attributed to his hand, has a great familiarity with the Corpus Iuris Civilis, which was produced about 100 years before he goes to Constantinople. It's composed under Justinian in the 530s, the 540s. Do you know anything about Byzantine law?
Not so much. More Gratian heavy.
Fair enough. I also don't know much about it. I actually have a copy of the corpus, but I have not cracked it open just yet. That's got to wait a little while for that. But we also know that Theodore became familiar here with medicine because, again, in his Eudicia, he leaves some notes about how to treat things like dysentery or bloodletting practices, which he would have learned in Constantinople. Now, again, we don't know how long he was spending in Constantinople, but at some point, and for some reason, we do not know the reason why, but he actually leaves Constantinople, and now he goes to his third of these really big, great cities. He goes to Rome. Now, Rome's definitely past its heyday at this point, but it's because of the massive influx of refugees from places like Antioch, Edessa, Jerusalem, and Alexandria. Rome has a lot of Eastern monks and clerics and lay people living in it. So it's actually experiencing a very interesting age at the time. We don't know if he approached Rome from the land. If he did, he was approaching from the north, and he might have visited a city like Ravenna, which was really in its heyday at this point, or he could have approached by the sea. But while he's spending his time at Rome, he lives as a monk, probably at the Eastern Monastery of Aquas Salvias, which is a monastery that's later dedicated to St. Anastasios, which is a Persian martyr. And it was primarily inhabited by people from Cilicia, the same province that Theodore's from. And so he's almost certainly living at this monastery, although it's not known for certain. But he is living as an Eastern monk in this Western city at Rome. And Theodore might have become, and this is something that's really interesting, I just learned this not long ago, that he might have been involved in the Monothelite controversy. Do you know anything about Monothelitism?
No, I do not.
So this is another one of those really heady, really intellectual controversies in the early church that to a lot of people don't make much sense, but back then they were very important to people. And it was an argument over whether or not Christ had one will or two wills. Now, the Monothelites obviously believed he had one will, and then the Duothelites believed he had two wills. And it was a very contentious time, but Theodore became involved in this controversy alongside many important figures, such as Pope Martin I, the Bishop of Rome at the time, as well as Maximus the Confessor, who's a very important Eastern saint living in Rome at the time. We know that he might have been part of this controversy because a monk named Theodore, Theodorus Monachus, was listed as a participant in the Lateran Council of 649, which wholesale condemned monothelitism and stirred up a lot of controversy in the church and created a bit of a schism between the East and the West for a few years. It can't be certain that this is our Theodore that we're talking about here, but it also can't be ruled out. And scholars, again, like LePage, really think it's pretty certain that this is the Theodore that we're talking about. He's listed pretty high. If it is, that means that Theodore is in Rome at least before the year 649, and that he has created quite a name for himself to be listed pretty high among the list of attendees at this council, alongside a lot of great theologians and alongside the Pope. So the Pope probably knows who Theodore is at this point, Pope Martin I, although Martin does not really get much of a chance to know him much better because not long after this council, he's exiled by the emperor in Constantinople, who's a man named Constans II. He's exiled and dies way out in the east. He's actually the last martyred pope. Now, what happened next is also quite obscure to us. But eventually, somehow, Theodore became acquainted with Hadrian. Now, Hadrian was an African man who was an abbot of a monastery not far from Neapolis. Neapolis is modern-day Naples, so in the south of Italy. It can't be confirmed, but it's likely that Hadrian, like Theodore, was also a refugee from the Arab invasions of North Africa, probably coming to Italy sometime in the 630s or the 640s. Now, it isn't known exactly how Theodore and Hadrian came to know each other, but we do know that they knew each other quite well, and Hadrian and him were at least friends to some degree, as we'll find out in 1 minute. So by the year 667, Theodore is still living as a monk in Rome. He's 66 years old at this point, again, if Bede is to be believed, which in all the research I've been doing the last couple months, I haven't seen any scholars really doubt that Bede is right here in saying that Theodore died at 88 years old. So here, Theodore is about 66, which is quite old for the time. Once you reach the age of adulthood at this time, you had a pretty good shot of living into your 60s. Especially somebody like Theodore, who's living as a monk, he's not, you know, doing like hard manual labor. So because he's living as a monk, that definitely is facilitating him to live to an older age. But at the age of 66, the year 667, a man named Wighard, who's the Archbishop-elect of Canterbury, is sent by King Ecgbert of Kent and the King of Northumbria to Rome to be consecrated as Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, I don't know how much you see in the 12th century, but I know in the early Middle Ages, especially before the 11th century at least, you see a lot of kings and other like political leaders being the ones that are appointing the bishops. I mean, Charlemagne did it like crazy, and pretty much a big chunk of Bede's ecclesiastical history describes the Archbishops of Canterbury and other bishops like the Bishops of York and Northumbria as being chosen basically by the local king.
Yeah, I mean, in the 12th century, it's a huge topic of debate. There's the spiritual sword, which is wielded by Rome, and that's excommunication. And then there's the temporal sword wielded by the monarchs. And in the Parisian schools, it gets decided that there's this more Montaigne view that the papacy always trumps the will of secular magnates or kings or what have you. And I think this is illustrated the best in the Becket affair, where it's, you know, who's in charge? Is it Henry II or is it Becket? And ultimately, Becket's martyrdom gets Henry II to back off.
Yeah, it definitely gets the best of him. Even from beyond the grave, Becket seems pretty sorry for what he did. So Wighard is chosen to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. So he comes to Rome and then pretty much dies immediately. I don't believe Bede mentions Wighard's age, but it sounds like he was quite old or quite frail and really wasn't right for this job. So by the time he gets to Rome, he's just so exhausted from the journey that he ends up just passing away. And the Pope at the time, Vitalian, he immediately sets about trying to find somebody to become the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And multiple times he goes to Hadrian and he's like, I want you to be the Archbishop of Canterbury. He asks Hadrian, he offers Hadrian the role of Archbishop. And Hadrian, being very humble, just declines it repeatedly. Hadrian offers up this man named Andrew. We don't know anything about him, but that Hadrian offered up a man named Andrew. Andrew also refused the appointment. And then finally, Hadrian is like, I'm not old enough for this position. I feel like I'm not experienced enough. So he brings to Pope Vitalian's attention Archbishop Theodore, or Theodore at the time. He's not the archbishop yet, who's, again, living as a monk in the city of Rome. Vitalian is kind of on the fence about Theodore at first, and this is another reason why we think that Theodore's involved in this controversy, is that I believe at this time, Constans II is still alive, and he's in Italy. So this very pro-monothelite emperor is in Italy at the time. He had killed, essentially, one of the previous popes, and Theodore was on the side of that pope at that council that condemned monothelitism. So scholars believe that this might be a reason why Vitalian was kind of cautious, because he didn't really want to stir up the pot with the emperor. He didn't want to see himself get exiled, even though I'm pretty sure Vitalian did also reject monothelitism. So Vitalian's a little bit cautious about Theodore, but he ends up relenting and he decides he will choose Theodore on two conditions. The first is that he wants Hadrian to go with Theodore to Canterbury. Vitalian really seems to like Hadrian a lot, and he really wants Hadrian to go to Canterbury. He really wants him to be leading the church. And it's kind of a pet theory, but in my mind, I like to think that maybe Vitalian thinks that Hadrian will outlast Theodore, and maybe after Theodore's done being Archbishop of Canterbury, maybe Hadrian will replace him. Now, that doesn't end up happening, but I like to think that maybe that's what Vitalian was hoping would happen. So that was the first condition. The second one is that he didn't want Theodore to have a Pauline tonsure. So what that means is that in this period of Christianity, a lot of clerics are tonsured, meaning they have their hair cut in a certain way. In the West, which at the time is called the Petrine style after St. Peter, that's the classic crown, like reverse bowl cut that you see monks have. It's the popular image people have when they hear the word monk, is of that traditional tonsure. The Pauline style that was more common in the East was just a completely shaved head. So the Pope basically told Theodore that he had to grow his hair out and get a haircut in the Western style if he wanted to be Archbishop of Canterbury. So Theodore did. He was tonsured in the proper way, and he was consecrated by Vitalian in Rome on the 26th of March, 668. And Theodore and Hadrian ended up departing for Canterbury not long after that, but they end up spending about a year in Francia. They kind of part ways for a bit. They spend time with different bishops and different political leaders. I believe Theodore ends up spending a winter with one of the mayors of the palace, who are kind of, at this point, they're becoming a lot more powerful, and the do-nothing kings of the Merovingian dynasty are kind of on their way, and the mayors of the palace are on their way to gaining more power. But eventually, after a very long amount of time, Theodore and Hadrian finally depart for England. They cross the English Channel, and they arrive in Canterbury in late May of 669. So more than a year goes past after he's actually consecrated as archbishop before he actually arrives in Canterbury. And now we finally get to arrive at what Theodore does as archbishop. But I think it's amazing, before we get into what he does in Canterbury, to just think about the fact that during this whole thing, he's engaged with Greek culture. He's raised with Greek culture in Tarsus. But then he also engages with a different kind of Greek culture in Antioch. Then he engages with Syriac culture and learns the Syriac language in Edessa. Then he goes to Constantinople, learns a slightly different Greek culture in Constantinople. He familiarizes himself with Constantinopolitan law. Then he learns Latin language and Latin culture in Rome and engages with that kind of culture there. And he does that if he gets there before 649 and leaves in 668, he's there for about 20 years, maybe even more. So he spends a huge chunk of his life in the West, and he becomes very familiar with Latin. So he's engaged with five cultures, just about.
And that's not even to mention the conquests. So he might have not learned Sassanid or Sasanian Persian culture to the same degree, or the nascent Islamic Arab culture, but he still interacts with those cultures as well.
Exactly. He definitely interacts with Persian culture. That is very true. And again, because we don't know for certain when he leaves Tarsus or Antioch or Edessa, we don't know exactly where he is when the Arab invasions happen. We don't know whether or not he leaves because of the invasions or if he had left earlier. But the scholarly consensus seems to be that it was because of the invasions. So he might have been even a little bit familiar with Arab culture. And this is everything that scholars are able to put together. I believe I saw in one of the writings that I read that he might have even gone all the way to places like Jerusalem. I feel like that would be pretty expected. You know, it would be quite a distance to travel, but compared to all the distance he's traveling to Canterbury, I think it's surely possible that he also went to Jerusalem. And again, it's still going to be Greek-speaking. I don't know if they're speaking Aramaic at the time still, but it's still going to be a different kind of culture. But now he's arriving in England, or I should say the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, the Kingdom of Kent. And now he's on his sixth, seventh culture. That's a lot. Obviously not really a contest, but I think Theodore might take the cake there. Now, in all the works I read, I can't seem to find anything mentioning whether or not Theodore learned or became familiar with Old English. There's not really much Old English literature from this period, the mid-600s. It starts to really come about a lot more in the 700s. I'm taking an Old English class right now, and I don't really think I see much Old English literature from this time, but people were speaking Old English. I have to imagine that Theodore is at least somewhat familiar with Old English, or he becomes somewhat familiar with Old English. He gets there in 669. He lives out the rest of his days. He's there till 690. That is plenty of time to at least become a little bit familiar with the language, especially if you're living completely surrounded by that. Obviously, he's going to be speaking Latin and learning and teaching people Latin and Greek and some Syriac probably. But I'd like to think he is at least familiarizing himself in some way with Old English. He's definitely familiarizing himself with Old English culture and interacting with it. Now, as he's in Canterbury, he does a lot of different things. As soon as he gets there, he goes to work addressing a bunch of different issues that the Church of Canterbury wasn't able to address without its archbishop. And by the time he gets there, 669, they hadn't had an archbishop for almost 6 years. Their last archbishop, Deus Dedit, died in 664. And although they sent Wighard to get consecrated, he died. So they had been without an archbishop. They still had bishops there on the island, but they were having some deficiencies there with leadership. So he automatically got right away to consecrating new bishops for a lot of dioceses that didn't have bishops. He was probably ordaining a lot of priests that were awaiting ordination. Hadrian was immediately appointed abbot of the monastery of St. Peter and St. Paul in Canterbury. This is later going to be called St. Augustine's in Canterbury. It's one of the most important monasteries in southern England, and it will remain the principal monastery in that area in Kent all the way up until the dissolution of the monasteries under Henry VIII. As well as this, Theodore conveyed a survey of the church throughout the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, and he called a council at Hertford in either 672 or 673. Also during his time, he ends up beefing, for lack of better terms, with another bishop, Bishop Wilfrid, I believe it is, over some appointments and over a couple theological issues. They end up resolving the conflict not long after, but it ends up being a pretty big thing that it ends up having to be answered by a couple political leaders have to step in and help solve the issue. But Theodore's lasting legacy on this early church in what is now modern-day England is the school he established at Canterbury. The school produces a massive amount of different intellectual works. They're copying a ton of manuscripts. They're disseminating manuscripts that had never been disseminated in England before. Tons of Greek works and Greek martyrs' lives and saints' lives are being brought into England that had never been brought before. People are learning Greek probably for the first time since before the year 410. So they're getting on in close to 300 years since there had been like any amount of Greek language really spoken on the island. It's funny how many Greek customs are introduced to Canterbury, because that was one of the worries that Pope Vitalian had when sending Theodore over, was he was worried there were going to be some like new Greek ideas, some new Eastern ideas that were introduced to the church at Canterbury. And what actually ended up happening is Theodore ended up introducing the filioque clause into the English church. And this is another reason why we think that Theodore was in Rome in the 640s, because there's a good chance he was interacting with Maximus the Confessor, who very proudly espoused the doctrine of the filioque. And the doctrine of the filioque is the idea that the Holy Spirit proceeds not only from God the Father, but also God the Son. It's adopted in the Western Church. It's pretty wholesale rejected by the Eastern Church by the fact that it's added pretty late, and it's not added by an ecumenical council, which the East has a big problem with. It's really remarkable to see the impact Theodore has on learning in the church in Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People. In the preface, on the first page, just at the bottom, Bede says this: "My principal authority and helper in this modest work has been the revered Abbot Albinus, a man of universal learning, who was educated in the Kentish Church by Archbishop Theodore and Abbot Hadrian of blessed memory, both venerable and learned men." What Bede is basically telling us there is that without Theodore and Hadrian's school established at Canterbury, we wouldn't have one of the greatest works of the early Middle Ages. And I think that's another lighting of the beacons, because it goes from Theodore and Hadrian to the students of Theodore and Hadrian, who many of them are still alive when Bede's writing, again, about a generation later. And then you got Bede, and then you got Bede's students. And it just keeps going on and on down the line, all the way to the Norman conquest with the end of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. And then that learning explodes in the Angevin Empire, which you and I took that class last semester.
Yeah, that passage from Bede really brings to mind an idea which still has a lot of currency in terms of a school, like the intellectual lineage. Who was your advisor taught by? Can you trace your way all the way back to, you know, Haskins, who founded the MAA, that kind of thing?
Exactly. And finally, to wrap this all up, Theodore of Tarsus died at the age of 88 on the 19th of September in the year 690. By the time he died, he had been serving as the Archbishop of Canterbury for 2 decades. Theodore's multicultural life is one that is often overlooked, but one that is massively interesting. He spent his formative years learning Greek, Persian, and Syriac culture, spending the first 30 or 40 or so of his life in the East, before spending the last 40 or so learning and interacting with Latin culture. Finally, he ended his days surrounded by Anglo-Saxon culture, a culture that was now benefiting in many ways from the multicultural life that was his own. I would like to once more thank the Medieval Academy of America and all of those working on the Multicultural Middle Ages podcast for giving me the opportunity to tell this story. I would like to also thank Thomas for joining me today. And lastly, I would like to thank Dr. Christina Bruno, the assistant head of the Medieval Studies program here at Fordham University, for bringing this podcast to my attention back in August. Thank you all for listening. This is your host, Christian Powell, signing off.
This has been an episode of the Multicultural Middle Ages, an anthology-style podcast series sponsored by the Medieval Academy of America. Season 4 was produced by Will Beatty, Jonathan Correa-Reyes, Reed O'Mara, Logan Quigley, and me, Lauren Lee, with music by Anna O'Connell. For more information on the MMA podcast, follow the links in the episode description and consider subscribing to keep up with the latest episodes. Thanks for listening.